So we continue in our study of these 12 ordinary men and the extraordinary task and calling to which they were called to serve as the ambassadors for Jesus. And we're really looking mostly at the time that they were with Jesus. Of course, he was preparing them for great work that they would do later, but we are particularly interested in that period of time when they were with the Lord while he was here upon this earth. And last week, we got to talk about kind of that first brother tandem, Peter and Andrew. We talked a little bit about how it seems like those guys had just very different personalities. It seems as if they just were opposite in so many ways. But we're looking at a set of brothers tonight who it actually seems are very much cut from the same cloth. In fact, James in the New Testament is always mentioned in conjunction with his brother John. And so that's why we're going to talk about both of them together. They probably both could have kind of merited their own lesson on their own, but I'd like for us to look at them together because there's a couple of episodes in their lives when they're kind of together and kind of singled out together. That sounds like an oxymoron, singled out together, but when their attention is called to them together and some things that we can learn from those scenes. They were, of course, among that group of fishermen. And yeah, Caleb, you feel free to do whatever you got to do with the ringing. I don't know. Yeah. They were among that group of fishermen that Jesus had invited to follow him and to become fishers of men. We've noticed that account a couple of times already in this study, there in Matthew chapter 4 and verses 18 through 22. It is interesting, actually, if you would look at that in Matthew chapter 4, I want to notice something about that. Because we're told in that account that their father Zebedee was with them in the boat when Jesus called them. And I might ought to just kind of restate what I've said a couple of times already, that the calling of the 12 was not necessarily a kind of a one-time thing where Jesus meets these guys for the very first time and says, follow me, and all of a sudden they're apostles. No, it was more of kind of a graduating up to being called to apostles. There was kind of a part-time following just as disciples, as there were many disciples of Jesus. But then there was the moment where Jesus then calls them to kind of an official apostolic role. But this is one of those occasions where Jesus calls them. Look at Matthew chapter 4 and verse 18. It says, "While walking by the Sea of Galilee, saw two brothers, Simon, who's called Peter, and Andrew, his brother, casting a net into the sea, for they were fishermen. And he said to them, follow me, and I'll make you fishers of men. And immediately they left their nets, and they followed him." Verse 21, "And going on from there, he saw two other brothers, James the son of Zebedee and John his brother, in the boat with Zebedee their father, mending their nets, and he called them." Verse 22 is the verse that always gets me. "And immediately they left the boat and their father, and they followed him." And so that says something about the dedication and the desire of these men to follow Jesus. Not only were they willing to leave work, but they were even willing to leave family. It seems, and it seems like a lot of scholars and folks tend to believe that maybe this was Zebedee's fishing business, and maybe they had kind of grew up learning the family trade, and maybe even somewhere along the way, Peter and Andrew then kind of joined them and kind of were part of that. We're told that Zebedee did have, you know, other workers, other employees, so it's believed that maybe Zebedee's family was maybe kind of well-to-do. James and John maybe got to grow up maybe being, you know, slightly more affluent than others who lived there in Galilee. It's also believed that Zebedee maybe was even related to some of the high priestly family, which maybe even gives a little bit of insight to the scene a little bit later on in the Gospels when John is able to kind of give Peter an in to come and follow Jesus at a distance when Jesus was arrested. He had that connection with the high priestly family. Since we're talking about the family, I do want to just kind of offer this as a side note. I don't want to belabor it, but I'll just kind of put it in your mind and maybe you go home and study on it and come back and tell me differently. There is the possibility that James and John may have actually been related to Jesus. There's the three different accounts in the Gospels that details some of the women who were at the cross when Jesus was crucified. And there's mention of three women in each of those accounts. The description of those three women kind of differs from account to account. There is Mary Magdalene, we know specifically. There is also Mary, the mother of James and Joseph, and she's also called the wife of Clopas. And then there's another woman who is mentioned. She's named Salome in Mark's account. And then in Matthew's account, she's described as being the mother of the sons of Zebedee. And then in John's account, she is referred to as Mary, Mary's sister, and that would be Mary, the mother of Jesus. And so if we add all of that together, if all of that's talking about the same woman, then we may actually have indication here that this woman, this mother of James and John, if that is the same Zebedee being referenced in those passages, that she may actually have been the sister of Mary, the mother of Jesus, which would make her the aunt of Jesus, which would then make James and John first cousins of Jesus. Now, that's not 100%, and that's some of my own sleuth detective work. There's even some divided thoughts about who those women were there at the cross standing with Mary, the mother of Jesus, but that's just a possibility that she may have actually been a part of that family, and James and John then would have been connected to Jesus. I'm going to actually draw upon that to make a point a little bit later when we get a little bit further in the study. One of the first things, though, that we learn about James and John in the calling of the apostles is this very special name that Jesus gives them. In Mark chapter 3, Mark's the only one who records this. In Mark 3 and in verse 17, in the calling of the 12, we're told in the middle of that, James the son of Zebedee and John the brother of James, to whom Jesus gave the name Boanerges, that is, sons of thunder. Now, I see that name, that kind of as a nickname, and I think that's a pretty cool name. That sounds pretty neat. What do you make of that? Maybe before we even get into some of the specifics, what maybe would come to your mind as to why Jesus would give them that nickname? Which is question number one. All right. It probably is an indication, an early indication of the personalities of these men. I want you to notice a passage. This is helpful as we think about Jesus. In John chapter 2, this tells us something about kind of how Jesus operated, and it's just a helpful piece of insight. In John chapter 2 and verses 24 and 25, we're given insight to the fact that Jesus knew what was inside a person even before he'd ever really even needed to spend time with them or to collect data and information about them. John chapter 2, verses 24 and 25, Jesus on his part did not entrust himself to them because he knew all people and he needed no one to bear witness about man, for he himself knew what was in a man. And I think that's even true, speaking of James and John, and of course any of the apostles, but Jesus knew something about these guys, you know, right away, before we even are introduced to some of the characteristics that maybe would make it fitting for them to be called the sons of thunder. But Jesus knew something about their personalities. I think it's going to be obvious to us this evening that they did have kind of, you know, thunderous personalities. And by that, I mean they were bold at times. They were outspoken at times. They were intense, maybe a little bit impatient at times. They were zealous, even to a fault. And I think that's what we'll especially see as we look at kind of the personality of these guys in the early stages of their discipleship. It probably does explain to us why they were maybe kind of part of that inner circle with Peter. We noted, I think, last week or the week before, Peter, James, and John got to be a part of just some very special moments with Jesus. It seems like he had maybe kind of a closer relationship with those guys, so that they got to be involved in some things. And if they have kind of this thunderous, boisterous kind of personality, then it just kind of makes sense that they're going to pair up with Peter. Because Peter was very much that kind of guy as well. Very just forward and very boisterous in a lot of ways. It is a powerful quality. But it is a powerful quality that can be used in a negative way. And at the same time, it can also be used in a positive way. It needs to be coupled and it needs to be tempered with the right kind of characteristics. I think we see that. Maybe the best example of that is this next question from Luke chapter 9. Let's look in Luke chapter 9. You read this passage, and this is where you would probably go, oh, yeah, okay, now I see why they're called the sons of thunder. In Luke chapter 9, this is when Jesus is actually kind of, he's got his sights set on heading toward Jerusalem. He's going to go to, of course, be a part of the Passover festivities and all the things that would go along with that. But we're told this in Luke chapter 9, beginning in verse 51, when the days drew near for him to be taken up, he, that's Jesus, set his face to go to Jerusalem. And he sent messengers ahead of him who went and entered a village of the Samaritans to make preparations for him. The idea here is that Jesus is going to maybe need to stop in Samaria to maybe have some hospitality be extended to him of some sort, whether that's a meal or maybe that's lodging of some kind. So he sends some guys on ahead to you know, see if there's going to be some folks who are going to be willing to offer that. Verse 53, though, but the people did not receive him because his face was set toward Jerusalem. I'll come back to that in just a second. And when his disciples, James and John, saw it, they said, Lord, do you want us to tell fire to come down from heaven and consume them? But he turned and rebuked them, and they went on to another village. Now, if your Bible's like mine, it's got a couple of footnotes in that passage because there's some manuscripts that don't all contain all the same language. For example, there at the end of verse 54, there when they said, you know, do you want us to call down fire? There's the additional note, do you want us to do that just as Elijah did? And then as well, in verse 55, the rebuke that Jesus gives. There's some manuscripts that give more specifics when Jesus said, you don't know what manner of spirit you are of, for the Son of Man came not to destroy people's lives, but to save them. Now, what quality is evident right here already with these guys? Just from that one scene, if that's all you've ever seen about these guys, what word or words or ideas come to your mind when you see them here, James and John? They're dedicated to the Lord, all right, so we're going to put that in the positive column. What else here? All right, impetuous. Shannon, for those of us that are not walking thesauruses, give us a...
I think it means like Peter, just acts without thinking.
Okay, all right. Maybe impetuous. There we go, that's the word he's looking for. All right. All right, a little impulsive. And being impulsive and being kind of a go-getter, that's, again, it's not always a bad quality, but it does seem as if some of that here is kind of bordering on there's a wrong attitude, there's a wrong spirit here. And that, of course, is very evident in the fact that Jesus rebukes them. Of course, we need to understand a little bit about the feeling that exists between Jews and between Samaritans. Who are the Samaritans? Who are these people? All right, they were sometimes just kind of looked at as kind of half-breeds. They were the people who were kind of the byproduct. They were the ones who were born from the intermarrying that took place between Israelites and some of those who then occupied their lands during the Assyrian captivity. And so there's some of these Gentile people that start intermarrying with Israelite people, and you get kind of these mixed-race people. And as a result, not only are they kind of mixed in their race and ethnicity, but they also have kind of a mixed synthesis in their religious thinking. These are people who have some understanding of Jehovah, but the religion and their worship and their practices and all their ideas about Jehovah are not entirely correct. It's kind of mixed with some pagan, and so they have kind of a, you know, kind of almost a half-breed religion. And that, of course, caused just constant conflict between Jews and Samaritans, so much so that if you were traveling and you needed to get to Jerusalem, well, the easiest route, the quickest route, would be to go through Samaria. But oftentimes, Jews, because of their hatred towards Samaritans, they'd go all the way around Samaria because they just didn't even want to walk through their territory. Well, Jesus was not of that ilk. Jesus was fine with walking right through their territory because he came for those people, came for all people. And so on this particular occasion, we're told Jesus is heading toward Jerusalem. He's going to Jerusalem to observe the religious things that would have been necessary for Jews to participate in. Obviously, the Samaritans are aware of that. Well, we don't want anything to do with that guy. We know how those Jews treat us. We don't want nothing to do with that. In fact, he's going to Jerusalem for their Jerusalem worship. Where'd the Samaritans worship? You may know that offhand. Mount Gerizim. You read in John chapter 4, Jesus has that conversation with the Samaritan woman. They were totally fine. Just we worship God over here on our mountain. Why do we need to go over here to your all's mountain? And so there was just always just odds with them. And these people do not receive Jesus. And so when James and John catch wind of this, well, it seems like kind of right to be upset a little bit. You know, why don't you receive him? You know, he's the Lord. He's the miracle worker. He is the famous rabbi here in all the land. You all need to show him some respect. And so they're upset about that. They're bothered about that. Their dedication to Jesus is shining through here. But then their impulsiveness begins to take hold. It's not simply, Lord, well, this is upsetting. Let's just go on. Let's go on to another town. That's not what James and John say. Their response is, you know, Lord, maybe we need to talk to these people and help them to understand better who you are and what you've come here for. That would have been a good thing to say, but that's not what they said. Instead, what James and John says is, let's nuke them. Let's call down the fire. In fact, notice there's even maybe even a hint of arrogance in what they say there in Luke chapter 9. Look there in verse 54 again. Lord, do you want us to call this fire down? Part of me kind of wonders if they realize and they understand Jesus isn't going to do this. Jesus did not come to destroy people, so Jesus isn't going to rain down fire from heaven on these people. But hey, we'll do it for you. That way you don't have to do it, Jesus. We'll rain down the fire on these people, give these people what they deserve. They're rejecting you. And it is interesting that this area here where Samaria was located, it actually would have been probably around the same region where Elijah had previously. You read back in the book of Kings when Elijah called down the fire from heaven in the contest on Mount Carmel with the prophets of Baal. And so they're thinking, hey, we're doing something that's got some Old Testament precedent. And we're doing something that just kind of seems logical for the place and the time where we're at. And so, hey, let's do this. Jesus has to rebuke them because what are they missing? You know, if it's good to kind of have some fire and some passion and this kind of strong dedication to Jesus, what is it that's missing from their character here that they need to have? Need some humility? What else? They need some love. That's really what's missing here. Because Jesus had come for the purpose of seeking and saving the lost. And if these Samaritan people are indeed lost people, and no doubt at this point in time they would have been, what do they need? Do they need to die? No, they need to live so they can learn the truth, come to a knowledge of the truth, become disciples of Jesus themselves. And so while passion and zeal is most certainly an admirable quality, it is clear that that also needs to be tempered with love, with understanding, with some compassion. In fact, if you're still here in Luke chapter 9, notice this incident. I didn't include this in the material. Notice there's actually an incident with John that precedes this that once again I kind of think shows some just a lack of love and understanding for others. Just bump back up to the previous verses, verse 49. Luke 9, 49, John answered and said, Master, we saw somebody casting out demons in your name and we tried to stop him because he doesn't follow with us. In other words, somebody's out here doing miracles, but he's not part of our group. He's not part of our 12. And we told him he needed to stop that. Jesus said to him, don't stop him, for the one who is not against you is for you. Again, there's just not a whole lot of thought for other people, what other people are doing, the help and the things that other people might need. Again, there's maybe kind of almost a sense of arrogance that maybe James and John had carried with them, especially these guys had been amongst the first called by Jesus, and so maybe there was kind of a sense of pride in all of that. But their love for truth, wanting to stand up for what's right, good as that is, it needed to be coupled with love for people, with a care for people, with patience, with composure, with a diligence and readiness to teach people. I'm reminded of, this is back during my days when I was circuit preaching. I was still working at the county attorney's office, but I was doing lots of fill-in preaching. And I was preaching at a small congregation. I'm not going to say where because this is being recorded and I don't want to call attention to that congregation specifically. But a brother got up to lead the opening prayer on this particular Sunday morning. And he was praying something about, you know, asking the Lord to watch over our soldiers and people who are serving our country overseas and helping us to preserve our freedoms. And that was totally fine. But then as he continued to pray about that, he then went on to say, Lord, we pray that those that were in the Middle East, we pray that they would be just wiped off the face of this earth. Talking about those who maybe espouse Islam or just Middle Easterners in general. And of course, I'm sitting in the middle of the prayer and I like kind of peek up and look around like, did everybody else hear that? Did he really just pray that? It was hard to say amen at the end of that prayer. That was some real imprecatory kinds of praying. But that's problematic because it is not our place and not our desire to see people be terminated. It is our desire to see people be taught. And that's what James and John were kind of missing here on this occasion in Luke chapter 9. And it seems like maybe that was just kind of missing from their character here in the early stages of their walk with Christ. You know, it is interesting. I went back and I actually counted. And I've got a question on down here, a couple of questions down, that talks about the number of times that John talks about love and will write about love. But it's also interesting that John writes an awful lot about truth. By my count, in John's writings, John alludes to the word truth, or the Greek word for truth, 45 different times. It's actually more than any other writer in the New Testament. So John is very much for truth, and we need to be for truth, stand for truth, be ready to fight for truth, be ready to press the truth fervently. But it is also interesting that John later would be the guy who would write so much about love. We come to understand that the truth and love, there needs to be a balance there. Maybe that's maybe the practical takeaway here as we think about James and John and this characteristic that they're exhibiting here. There just needs to be a healthy balance. I want to stand up for Jesus. I want to stand up for what's right. I want to stand against sin and error. I hate those things. But that can never be to the neglect of recognizing that those things are coming from people. People who have souls. People whose souls are going to dwell somewhere for all of eternity. And I need to be mindful of that as I deal with folks and remember to always speak the truth in love, Ephesians chapter 4 tells us. What else do you want to say about this scene here in Luke chapter 9? I just say, hey, Sloan. Yeah. It's very possible. He, of course, is going to outlive all the rest of the apostles, going to live to an older age, and it is believed that he probably was amongst the younger of the guys. And again, this is where I start to see myself in these guys. I know that when I first was starting to do some preaching, I look back to some of the sermons that I preached during the first several years of my time as doing some preaching. And man, there was a lot of just hammering away at how people are wrong and this false doctrine's bad and we just need to show these people how wrong they are. Wasn't a whole lot of love in there. There wasn't a whole lot of compassion and care to help people come along and arrive to a better understanding and have a better grasp of the truth. And so sometimes that is one of the follies of youth. I appreciate you pointing that out. What else? Maybe. If you ever watch any of those superhero movies where I think about like the Spider-Man movie where Peter Parker first realizes he's got the ability to shoot the stuff out of his wrist and it's pretty cool. Wow, I've got this new power and look what I can do with it. And maybe you do kind of wonder if some of that kind of went to their head a little bit. I'll just say it is better to get fired up with some righteous indignation than to just sit idly by and don't ever do anything. Don't ever say nothing. That's a dangerous extreme. But at the same time, we don't want to get so fired up with righteous indignation that we're ready to, call down the hail, fire, and brimstone on people. There needs to be a balance. And this passage, I think, maybe kind of draws our attention to that. It is interesting, as we think here about the Samaritans, it is interesting that the gospel will ultimately come to this same region when you get to the book of Acts, and Acts chapter 8 in particular. And I do find it interesting that one of the apostles that gets sent down to Samaria to help there is one of these guys. It's John. And I wonder if that was intentional for the Spirit to have John go down there and to be a part of that, Acts chapter 8, verse 14. Let's draw our attention to this other account where the brothers are, there's some possible kind of good qualities going on here, but there also is kind of more heavily some not so good qualities happening here. I'm looking in Mark the 10th chapter. In Mark chapter 10, and we're going to draw up on Matthew's account as well momentarily. But in Mark chapter 10, this is probably one of the things we know, one of the more well-known accounts of James and John and some of the folly that comes out of their mouths. In Mark chapter 10, reading here beginning in verse, where am I? Mark chapter 10, verses 35. I'm in Matthew. Everybody else is there except me. Mark chapter 10, beginning in verse 35. The text tells us that James and John, the sons of Zebedee, they came up to Jesus and they said to him, "Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you." It's almost humorous just to even read that question. "Lord, we just want you to do whatever we ask you to do for us." Verse 36, he said to them, "Well, what do you want me to do for you?" And they said to him, "Grant us to sit, one at your right hand and one at your left, in your glory." Now, they, of course, have at least some understanding at this point that Jesus is establishing a kingdom. Now, they clearly do not understand everything about that kingdom. In fact, that is one of the greatest struggles that the apostles have while Jesus is still on the earth, is that they just can't grasp what this kingdom is going to be. They're thinking so much about physical things and not thinking so much about the spiritual concepts that Jesus is really trying to advance. But what they see is they see Jesus, he's going to be the king. And so what we want is we want to be kind of the, you know, lieutenant deputies or the vice presidents in that kingdom. Give us the kind of premier positions, right hand and left hand. Let us be kind of your two main enforcers in your kingdom. What's good about that or bad about that? If you already know how Jesus responds in the next few verses, you already know there's obviously kind of more bad about this than good. Maybe if I'm going to say something good about it is, okay, there's at least the acknowledgement and understanding that, well, Jesus is going to be a king, and he's going to have a kingdom. They want some responsibility. Hey, that's a plus, that's a positive. They're not, you know, trying to evade and avoid having any kind of role in that kingdom. So there's some pluses going on there. What's the negative about this? Yeah, there's once again, just a lot of foolishness bound up in this question. And it seems as if there is this kind of desire for some preeminence, not just any role or any responsibility. No, we want kind of a high level of responsibility. We want a lofty role. We want a role that shows greatness and that we really are something. Now, one of my follow-up questions here is, are James and John the only guys that have a problem with that in the 12? Who else has a problem with it? All of them. You're reading Luke's account, Luke chapter 9, verse 46. Luke says that they, and by they he means the disciples, like all of them, they were all disputing about this, about who's going to have greatness. In fact, that spills all the way over to the Last Supper. You're reading Luke chapter 22. They're still fussing about that. Still fussing about who's going to be the greatest, who's going to have the most lofty position in the kingdom. Think of all the places where you'd set that stuff to the side, it'd be at the Last Supper, but no, they're still fussing about it then. Matthew does give us a little additional wrinkle in Matthew chapter 20, and I want to notice that. There is an extra little piece of the puzzle that Mark chooses not to record. In Matthew chapter 20, I'm reading here beginning in verse 20, we're told that then the mother of the sons of Zebedee came up to him with her sons. And kneeling before him, she asked him for something. And he said to her, "What do you want?" And she said to him, "Say that these two sons of mine are to sit, one at your right hand and one at your left in your kingdom." Then Jesus answered, "You do not know what you are asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I am to drink?" And they said to him, "We are able." He said to them, "You will drink my cup, but to sit at my right hand and at my left, that's not mine to grant, but it is for those for whom it has been prepared by my Father." And when the 10 heard it, they were indignant at the two brothers. And so we see here that their mom, and if I'm making all the proper connections to the names of the women that were there at the cross, this may very well be Salome, whether it's Salome or whether she had a different name or it's a completely different woman. Mama has a role in this question to Jesus and this request to have her boys have the you know, special preeminent spots in his kingdom. I don't know if we're to take from this that maybe, you know, Mrs. Zebedee here is kind of one of those parents that, you know, just kind of spoils their kid a little bit, make sure to give their kid a trophy for like everything. The kind of parent that tells their kid, you know, you can be president of the United States of America and, like, really mean it. Maybe she's that kind of mom, that kind of a parent. I don't know. Or if maybe she really just wants what's best for her sons. She just really does, you know, love them and care for them, and she wants to see good things for them. Regardless here, there's just a lack of humility. There's a lack of humility on mom's part. And that spills over to a lack of humility on James and John's part. There's not an understanding of what the essence of the kingdom is, because the essence of the kingdom is going to be what? Service. Being a servant. Servanthood. Of course, Jesus will most famously illustrate that at the Last Supper in John the 13th chapter, but the way to move up in the kingdom is by bringing yourself low, by being willing to serve and to do for others. There's kind of an absence of that in these this teaching. In fact, in verse 25, Jesus, that's what he just pounds away at. Verse 25, you're still there in Matthew chapter 20. He says, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. But it shall not be so among you. Whoever would be great among you must be your servant. And whoever would be first among you must be your slave. Even as the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give His life as a ransom for many." What Jesus says is, He says, you follow my example. My example is to come here and to serve. Jesus is the ultimate example of what it means to serve others. You just serve in the here and in the now. And we'll let God handle the awards and the seating arrangement in heaven. God's going to take care of all that. God's got all that under control. You just concern yourself with being a servant in the here and in the now. And once again, this is just an important reminder for us that this is not a competition. We are not competing with our brothers and sisters. We're not trying to outdo each other in any... Well, maybe if there's one thing we're to outdo one another in, it's in honor. And in fact, I think that's what the lesson's going to be this coming Sunday in the One Another series, to honor one another, outdo one another in honor, Paul would write, and having concern for others. Maybe that's a good thing to strive to, you know, kind of one-up each other in. But that's only because we're focused on others. It's not about me. It's about service. And it's about recognizing that we're all on the same team, and we're all trying to achieve the same goal. And that was, I'm sure, one of the reasons that the other apostles got indignant when they heard this request. Not only because maybe they wanted that position, but also it just disrupted the idea that, well, I thought we were all a team. I thought we were all trying to accomplish the same goals. I thought we were all trying to work for the master and all of us, you know, enjoy the blessings of being in the kingdom and being a part of the master's family. This kind of rivalry and lack of humility never leads to anywhere good. I do wonder, and I think about John in particular, I do think this is something that he learned. And I think we even see it near the end of Jesus' life, and I think Jesus saw it. Do you remember in John chapter 19? What does Jesus ask John to do? What does Jesus see that John has kind of matured to a point where he can be ready to accept an important duty of humble service? What's he asked John to do in John 19 while he's on the cross? Take care of my mother. That's your mom now. And I think that probably shows that somewhere in the seam of Luke 9 and Mark chapter 10 up until the time of the cross, John had done some growing and had developed. And I'd like to hope that James had as well. And certainly as they continue to progress on throughout the New Testament, we know that they developed that more and more as they continue to grow. What else about this episode comes to your mind as we look at these guys? Well, let me not make the mistake of going, Briley. You thought I didn't catch you. You did. Yeah. That's exactly right. And it's not wrong to petition the Lord for something. It's not wrong to make requests in prayer as we often do. But as you said, it needs to be, it's one of those things we want to temper that with the recognition that whatever's going to bring God the most glory, Lord, that's what I want. That's what I'm most interested in. And James and John here, we're needing to learn that lesson, that this is about God's glory. It's about the glory of Jesus here. It is interesting, you know, we read those verses there in Matthew 20 where Jesus said that about the cup of suffering. He said, you know, you're not able to drink the cup that I'm going to drink. But they said, oh, we're able to. And then Jesus tells them, well, you will drink that cup. It is interesting that about 14 years later, James is going to be the first one to drink that cup to the full. And he's going to drink it in his own execution and in his own death. In fact, let me skip question number four and let's just go right there to question number five because we are running short on time. James was the first apostle. Acts chapter 12 records for us he was the first of the apostles to die for Christ, to be killed for the faith. He's not the first martyr in the New Testament, but he is the first of the apostles for that to happen to. What's interesting, though, there in Acts chapter 12 is that in the verses that follow, Herod, of course, had killed James by the sword, but he also then, when he sees that that curries him some favor with the Jews, he realizes, oh, okay, I'll just start picking off all the rest of these apostles. And so he gets a hold of Peter, and the intention is, we're going to kill Peter as well. You know, we're going to try to kind of, you know, cut off the head of what maybe he viewed as this, you know, this religious movement going on. We'll just cut off the apostles, and that'll take care of all of this. And of course, if you know the story in Acts chapter 12, Peter actually ends up escaping. Angel of the Lord comes and delivers him from prison, and Peter gets to live. I got to tell you, though, I've always thought about that story, and I've often thought, John's brother died. Andrew's brother got to live. What about that? Is there something from that just that thought, that realization? Is there maybe some lessons that we can learn from that? Anything that maybe just comes to your mind as you think about James not being spared on this occasion? This is still, like I said, this is, you know, 13, 14 years after Jesus had said those words to him. So we're still, you know, relatively in the infancy of the New Testament church. But the Lord allows an apostle to die. What do we make of that? If anything. All right. That's one of the first things that comes to mind is that, you know, the Lord, He has different priorities than we do. He, you know, the way that we think things ought to go just is not always the way that the Lord sees fit for things to go. What else?
It's obvious that Peter had some work to do still. First got the sermon, goes on to do much more, write a book of the Bible, to maybe James
and Yeah, and we don't know all of that. The Lord definitely knew. The Lord was going to, you know, if the Lord saw that it was necessary for James to live, I'm sure he would have made it possible for him to have been spared on that occasion. I am reminded of Jesus' prayer for the disciples in John 17. Do you remember that prayer? Amongst the things that he prays for them in John 17, verse 24, he prayed, Father, I desire that they also, whom you have given me, that they may be with me where I am to see my glory that you have given me. Have you thought about the fact that James, he got to be the first apostle to experience that? Which makes me wonder if maybe even when James was in custody and, you know, he knows that Herod's fixing to send the soldier down to bring him to the chopping block, it actually makes me wonder whether James really was putting up that much of a fight and even wanting to be released. In the book of Hebrews chapter 11, that's that great chapter on faith, and we get all those examples of people who demonstrated great faith. There at the end of the chapter, there's kind of some general statements that are made, and I wonder if James fits into this one. In Hebrews chapter 11 and in verse 35, it says that there were women who received back their dead by resurrection, but then notice this, some were tortured, refusing to accept release so that they might rise again to a better life. I wonder if James was kind of already thinking in those terms. All right, I'm going to die. This is what the Lord's will is, that I'm going to die here. I'm good with that because things are going to be a lot better for me when I get to the other side of here. Maybe just the other thing that James's death on that occasion would have demonstrated to Herod and to the other opponents of Christianity was that even though James died, the church didn't die. Christianity didn't die. Christianity was not, all wrapped up in just these apostles. By this point, this was a huge movement. There was becoming a worldwide movement at that point. In fact, in the wake of James's death, the church grew even more. Acts chapter 12, verse 24 tells us that they continued to grow. Since we're talking about that, let's just kind of wrap up very quickly here with talking about John, because John is, by all accounts, he's the last of the apostles to die. He's the only one that did not die, at least from what we can tell, did not die the death of a martyr. I've asked this question, and I guess the answer is obvious, but does this mean that John didn't suffer as an apostle? You know, the fact that he didn't get crucified upside down like Peter, or the fact that he didn't get, you know, didn't get his head chopped off like James did by Herod, does that mean he didn't suffer as an apostle? He was like, he got to be spared from all the things that the other 11 endured. Think about just the pain of that. You know, the suffering of first watching your brother, well, maybe not watching, but knowing your brother died in the manner in which he did and for the cause which he died. And then seeing each of your kind of brothers in arms being picked off one by one and having to live, you know, a really long life. The truth is, even by the end of John's life, best we can tell, it was near close to the end of the first century that John gets to live to. But by that point, the Roman government's problems with Christianity and some of those things were starting to really ratchet up in intensity. John's had to kind of live through a lot of that and see a lot of that take place. He's exiled there on the Isle of Patmos, and he's a partner in the tribulation, as he says and introduces in Revelation chapter 1, verse 9. Maybe didn't suffer in the exact same way that James did, but he is still a suffering servant for the Lord. It is believed that when he died, and I'll close with this, this is a quote from one of the early historians, Jerome. He noted that John was very frail and would have to actually be carried in to the assembly. It's believed that John did some work with the church at Ephesus. And whenever he did, was brought into those assemblies, there was one phrase that was constantly on his lips. He would say, "My little children, love one another." And when he was asked why he always said this, John's reply was, "It's the Lord's command. And if this alone is done, it is enough." And that's exactly right. When we are loving one another, that encompasses so many other things, and we are fulfilling the purpose for which we have been placed upon this earth and placed within this kingdom. John writes so much about love. And like I said, that's just so evident in his own writings and the epistles. It's evident even in the writing of that gospel account. John came to understand that there needed to be that balance, and it was something that he had to learn and grow into. And that's one of the things that I take great comfort in as I study these guys, that these guys just didn't have it all together in the beginning. It was a work in progress for each of them. Final thoughts. I've went over again tonight, but who wants the last word? Anybody? Joel, you were quiet all night long. I know you want to say something. All right. We'll pick up next week, lesson number 5. We'll talk about Philip. This is kind of the section of the study that I kind of get excited for, because we now get to kind of start to study about some of these guys that we don't know as much about. We get to kind of highlight the biblical thoughts that are recorded about them. Appreciate your participation tonight.